Tiefling, Tales of Romance. I'm Mardell, reading The Blue Castle by L.M. Montgomery. Chapter 8. Valency did not sleep that night. She lay awake all through the long dark hours, thinking. She made a discovery that surprised her. She, who had been afraid of almost everything in life, was not afraid of death. It did not seem in the least terrible to her, and she need not now be afraid of anything else. Why had she been afraid of things? Because of life. Afraid of Uncle Benjamin because of the menace of poverty and old age. But now she would never be old, neglected, tolerated. Afraid of being an old maid all her life. But now she would not be an old maid very long. Afraid of offending her mother and her clan because she had to live with and among them and couldn't live peaceably if she didn't give in to them. But now she hadn't. Valency felt a curious freedom. But she was still horribly afraid of one thing, the fuss the whole jamfrey of them would make when she told them. Valency shuddered at the thought of it. She couldn't endure it. Oh, she knew so well how it would be. First, there would be indignation, yes, indignation on the part of Uncle James, because she had gone to a doctor, any doctor, without consulting him. Indignation on the part of her mother for being so sly and deceitful. To your own mother, Doss. Indignation on the part of the whole clan because she had not gone to Dr. Marsh. And then would come the solicitude she would be taken to Dr. Marsh, and when Dr. Marsh confirmed Dr. Trent's diagnosis, she would be taken to specialists in Toronto and Montreal. Uncle Benjamin would foot the bill with a splendid gesture of munificence in thus assisting the widow and orphan, and talk forever after of the shocking fees specialists charged for looking wise and saying they couldn't do anything. And when the specialists could do nothing for her, Uncle James would insist on her taking purple pills. I have known them to effect a cure when all the doctors had given up. And her mother would insist on Red Fern's blood bitters, and Cousin Stickles would insist on rubbing her over the heart every night with Red Fern's liniment on the grounds that it might do good and couldn't do harm, and everybody else would have some pet dope for her to take. Dr. Stalling would come to her and say solemnly, "You are very ill. Are you prepared for what may be before you?" Almost as though he were going to shake his forefinger at her, the forefinger that had not grown any shorter or less knobbly with age. And she would be watched and checked like a baby, and never let do anything or go anywhere alone. Perhaps she would not even be allowed to sleep alone, lest she die in her sleep. Cousin Stickles or her mother would insist on sharing her room and bed. Yes, undoubtedly they would. It was this last thought that really decided Valency. She could not put up with it, and she wouldn't. As the clock in the hall below struck 12, Valency suddenly and definitely made up her mind that she would not tell anybody. She had always been told ever since she could remember that she must hide her feelings. "It is not ladylike to have feelings," Cousin Stickles had once told her disapprovingly. Well, she would hide them with a vengeance. But though she was not afraid of death, she was not indifferent to it. She found that she resented it. It was not fair that she should have to die when she had never lived. Rebellion flamed up in her soul as the dark hours passed by. Not because she had no future, but because she had no past. "I'm poor. I'm ugly. I'm a failure. And I'm near death," she thought. She could see her own obituary notice in the Deerwood Weekly Times, copied into the Port Lawrence Journal. A deep gloom was cast over Deerwood, etc., etc. Leaves large circle of friends to mourn, etc., etc. Lies. All lies. Gloom, forsooth. Nobody would miss her. Her death would not matter a straw to anybody. Not even her mother loved her. Her mother, who had been so disappointed that she was not a boy, or at least a pretty girl. Valency reviewed her whole life, between midnight and the early spring dawn. It was a very drab existence, but here and there an incident loomed out with a real significance out of all proportion to its real importance. These incidents were all unpleasant, in one way or another. Nothing really pleasant had ever happened to Valency. I've never had one wholly happy hour in my life. Not one, she thought. I've just been a colorless nonentity. I remember reading somewhere once that there is an hour in which a woman might be happy all her life if she could but find it. I've never found my hour. Never. Never. And I never will now. If I only could have had that hour, I'd be willing to die. Those significant incidents kept bobbing up in her mind like unbidden ghosts, without any sequence of time or place. For instance, that time when at 16 she blew a tub full of clothes too deeply, and the time when at 8 she had stolen some raspberry jam from Aunt Wellington's pantry. Valency never heard the last of those two misdemeanors. At almost every clan gathering, they were raked up against her as jokes. Uncle Benjamin hardly ever missed retelling the raspberry jam incident. He had been the one to catch her, her face all stained and streaked. I've really done so few bad things that they have to keep harping on the old ones, thought Valency. Why, I've never even had a quarrel with anyone. I haven't an enemy. What a spineless thing I must be, not to even have one enemy. Then there was that incident of the dust pile at school when she was 7. Valency always recalled it when Dr. Stalling referred to the text, "To him that hath given shall be given, and from him that hath not shall be taken, even that which he hath." Other people might puzzle over that text, but it never puzzled Valency. The whole relationship between her and Olive, dating from the day of the dust pile, was a commentary on it. She had been going to school a year, but Olive, who was a year younger, had just begun, and had about her all the glamour of a new girl, and an exceedingly pretty girl at that. It was at recess, and all the girls, big and little, were out on the road in front of the school making dust piles. The aim of each girl was to have the biggest pile. Valency was good at making dust piles. There was an art in it, and she had secret hopes of leading. But Olive, working off by herself, was suddenly discovered to have a larger dust pile than anybody. Valency felt no jealousy. Her dust pile was quite big enough to please her. Then one of the older girls had an inspiration. "Let's pull all our dust on Olive's pile and make a tremendous one," she exclaimed. A frenzy seemed to seize the girls. They swooped down on the dust piles with pails and shovels, and in a few seconds Olive's pile was a veritable pyramid. In vain. Valency, with scrawny, outstretched little arms, tried to protect hers. She was ruthlessly swept aside, her dust pile scooped up and poured on Olive's. Valency turned away resolutely and began building another dust pile. Again a bigger girl pounced on it. Valency stood before it, flushed, indignant, arms outspread. "Don't take it," she pleaded. "Please don't take it." "But why?" demanded the older girl. "Why won't you help to build Olive's bigger?" "I want my own little dust pile," said Valency piteously. Her plea went unheeded. While she argued with one girl, another scraped up her dust pile. Valency turned away, her heart swelling, eyes full of tears. "Jealous! You're jealous!" said the girls mockingly. "You were very selfish," said her mother coldly, when Valency told her about it at night. That was the first and last time Valency had ever taken any of her troubles to her mother. Valency was neither jealous nor selfish. It was only that she wanted a dust pile of her own, small or big, mattered not. A team of horses came down the street, and Olive's dust pile was scattered over the roadway. The bell rang. The girls trooped into school and had forgotten the whole affair before they reached their seats. Valency never forgot it. To this day she resented it in her secret soul. But was it not symbolical of her all her life? "I've never been able to have my own dust pile," thought Valency. The enormous red moon she had seen rising right at the end of the street one autumn evening of her sixth year. She had been sick and cold with the awful, uncanny horror of it. So near to her, so big. She had run in trembling to her mother, and her mother had laughed at her. She had gone to bed and hidden her face under the clothes in terror, lest she might look at the window and see that horrible moon glaring in her through it. The boy who had tried to kiss her at a party when she was 15, she had not let him. She had evaded him and run. He was the only boy who had ever tried to kiss her. Now, 14 years later, Valency found herself wishing that she had let him. The time she'd been made to apologize to Olive for something she hadn't done. Olive had said that Valency had pushed her into the mud and spoiled her new shoes on purpose. Valency knew she hadn't. It had been an accident, and even that wasn't her fault. But nobody would believe her. She had to apologize and kiss Olive to make up. The injustice of it burned in her soul tonight. That summer, when Olive had the most beautiful hat, trimmed with creamy yellow net, with a wreath of red roses and little ribbons under the chin. Valency had wanted a hat like that more than she had ever wanted anything. She pleaded for one and had been laughed at. All summer, she had to wear a horrid little brown sailor with elastic that cut behind her ears. None of the girls would go around with her because she was so shabby. Nobody but Olive. People thought Olive was so sweet and unselfish. I was an excellent foil for her, thought Valency. Even she knew that. Valency had tried to win a prize for attendance in Sunday school once. But Olive won it. There were so many Sundays, Valency had to stay home because she had colds. She had once tried to say a piece in school one Friday afternoon and had broken down in it. Olive was a good reciter and never got stuck. That night she had spent in Port Lawrence with Aunt Isabel when she was 10. Brian Sterling was there from Montreal, 12 years old, conceited, clever. At family prayers in the morning, Byron had reached across and given Valency's thin arm such a savage pinch that she screamed out with pain. After prayers were over, she was summoned to Aunt Isabel's bar of judgment. But when she said that Byron had pinched her, Byron denied it. He said she cried out because the kitten scratched her. He said she put the kitten up on her chair and was playing with it when she should have been listening to Uncle David's prayer. And he was believed. In the Sterling clan, the boys were always believed before the girls. Valency was sent home in disgrace because of her exceeding bad behavior during family prayers. And she was not asked to Aunt Isabel's again for many moons. The time Cousin Betty Sterling was married, somehow Valency got wind of the fact that Betty was going to ask her to be one of her bridesmaids. Valency was secretly uplifted. It would be a delightful thing to be a bridesmaid. And of course she would have to have a new dress for it, a pretty new dress, a pink dress. Betty wanted her bridesmaids to dress in pink. But Betty had never asked her, after all. Valency couldn't guess why, but long after her secret tears of disappointment had been dried, Olive told her. Betty, after much consultation and reflection, had decided that Valency was too insignificant. She would spoil the effect. That was 9 years ago, but tonight Valency caught her breath with the old pain and the sting of it. That day in her 11th year, when her mother had badgered her into confessing something she'd never done, Valency had denied it for a long time, but eventually, for peace's sake, she gave in and pleaded guilty. Mrs. Frederick was always making people lie by pushing them into situations where they had to lie. Then her mother had made her kneel down on the parlor floor between herself and Cousin Stickles and say, "Oh God, please forgive me for not speaking the truth." Valency had said it, but as she rose from her knees, she muttered, "But, oh God, you know I did speak the truth." Valency had not then heard of Galileo, but her fate was similar to his. She was punished just as severely as if she hadn't confessed and prayed. The winter she went to dancing school. Uncle James had decreed she should go and had paid for her lessons. How she had looked forward to it, and how she had hated it. She had never had a voluntary partner. The teacher always had to tell some boy to dance with her, and generally he had been sulky about it. Yet Valency was as good a dancer, as light on her feet as thistledown. Olive, who never lacked eager partners, was heavy. The affair of the button string when she was 10. All the girls in school had button strings. Olive had a very long one with a great many beautiful buttons. Valency had one. Most of the buttons on it were very commonplace, but she had six beauties that had come off Grandmother Sterling's wedding gown, sparkling buttons of gold and glass, much more beautiful than any Olive had. Their possession conferred a certain distinction on Valency. She knew every little girl in school envied her the exclusive possession of those beautiful buttons. When Olive saw them on the button string, she had looked at them narrowly but said nothing. Then, the next day, Aunt Wellington had come to Elm Street and told Mrs. Frederick that she thought Olive should have some of those buttons. Grandmother Sterling was just as much Wellington's mother as Frederick's. Mrs. Frederick had agreed amiably. She could not afford to fall out with Aunt Wellington. Moreover, the matter was of no importance whatever. Aunt Wellington carried off four of the buttons, generously leaving two for Valency. Valency had torn these from her string and flung them on the floor. She had not yet learned that it was unladylike to have feelings, and had been sent supperless to bed for the exhibition. The night of Margaret Blunt's party, she had made such pathetic efforts to be pretty that night. Rob Walker was to be there, and two nights before, on the moonlight veranda of Uncle Herbert's cottage at Mistewis, Rob had really seemed attracted to her. At Margaret's party, Rob never even asked her to dance. Did not notice her at all. She was a wallflower, as usual. That, of course, was years ago. People in Deerwood had long since given up inviting Valency to dances. But to Valency, its humiliation and disappointment were of the other day. Her face burned in the darkness as she recalled herself sitting there with her pitifully crimped, thin hair, and the cheeks she had pinched for an hour before coming in an effort to make them red. All that came of it was a wild story that Valency Sterling was rouged at Margaret Blunt's party. In those days in Deerwood, that was enough to wreck your character forever. It did not wreck Valency's or even damage it. People knew she couldn't be fast if she tried. They only laughed at her. "I've had nothing but a second-hand existence," decided Valency. "All the great emotions of life have passed me by. I've never even had a grief. And have I ever really loved anybody? Do I really love Mother? No, I don't. And that's the truth, whether it's disgraceful or not. I don't love her. I've never loved her. What's worse, I don't even like her. So I don't know anything about any kind of love. My life has been empty. Empty. Nothing is worse than emptiness. Nothing. Valancy ejaculated the last nothing aloud passionately. Then she moaned and stopped thinking about anything for a while. One of her attacks of pain had come on. When it was over, something had happened to Valancy. Perhaps the culmination of the process that had been going on in her mind ever since she had read Dr. Trent's letter. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, the wisest and most accursed hour of the clock. But sometimes it sets us free. I've been trying to please other people all my life and failed, she said. After this, I shall please myself. I shall never pretend anything again. I've breathed an atmosphere of fibs and pretenses and invasions all my life. What a luxury it will be to tell the truth. I may not be able to do much that I want to do, but I won't do another thing that I don't want to do. Mother can pout for weeks. I shan't worry over it. Despair is a free man. Hope is a slave. Valancy got up and dressed. With the deepening of that curious sense of freedom. When she had finished with her hair, she opened the window and hurled the jar of potpourri over into the next lot. It smashed gloriously against the schoolgirl complexion on the old carriage shop. I'm sick of the fragrance of dead things, said Valancy. Please join me next time for another romantic chapter of The Blue Castle by L.M. Montgomery, here on Love's Tender Flame. Till next time, love deeply and live beautifully.